Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined by the host with the most, the Hall of Fame of the Difference Maker, Mr. Tony Sager. Tony, how are you, sir?
Doing great, Sean. Doing great. We're surviving Snowpocalypse 26.
Absolutely. We're joined by two very special guests, one very familiar to our audience, Mr. Randy Rose. Randy, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing fantastic. And a newcomer to the podcast, Kyle Leonard. Kyle, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Wonderful. So we've been going through, myself and Tony, have been going through our 2026 predictions, and we get to yours, Randy, yours and the team's, really, and we're like, we're not going to fit this in an episode. I mean, we had to do two episodes for the others, and then we have seven of your predictions, and we were like, let's bring the team on, let's discuss these, get your perspectives as we go through, because they're really detailed, and they're, excellent. And so we wanted to bring you, and I know you mentioned in the blog post for the predictions, Randy, that this was a team effort, you and your team putting these together, and so we thought, well, let's bring you, and you've invited Kyle, and we'll walk through them, get your perspectives, your ideas, and, you know, it's towards the end of the month, if any come true so far in 2026. We will see. But Randy, let me jump off. I'm going to just walk through the first one. I'll get your perspective, and then we'll go backwards and forwards, if that makes sense. Now, we start with... And this is an interesting one. This is the cross-platform campaigns are becoming the norm. So this normalization of cyber threat actors using and designing payloads that are executing across Windows, Linux, and even Mac OS. So one, reducing the need for separate code bases, increasing the reach, likely to see some more unified frameworks capable of compromising mixed environments with a single campaign. So the malware itself will be likely more of the same, but still talking about info stealers, loaders, ransomware, spyware, all our common enemies, as it were, and much of it coming from familiar families. So it looks like it's still the same genealogy in the space, Randy, as well. But what will change is how adaptable and efficient these threats become. So Randy, wanted to get your thoughts on the first prediction.
Yeah, I think we are actually already seeing this play out. So, you know, you asked that question, you know, are we seeing, we're a month in, right? We're a month into 2026. Have any of our predictions come true? I think we are starting to see this. I mean, attackers are surely going to continue to build separate tools for devices that they're interested in targeting. But there's this, you know, push towards efficiency. And I think this is where generative AI comes into play a lot. There's a lot of cross-platforming in the industry just in general. We rely on a lot of the same things, regardless of whether or not you're using a Linux machine or a Windows machine or an iPhone or an Android phone. A lot of the cross-platform use cases are there, right? Things that used to only be available on iPhone are now available on Android. So if you're an attacker and you're interested in going after, say, you know, personal information, or you're interested in launching a ransomware attack, the opportunities are there for you to build a single tool or a single capability that can leverage those, that cross-platform functionality between them. I think I've said this on the podcast before, that generative AI is like the great equalizer. So if you only knew how to do one thing before, and you specialized in this one area, you're able to use tools like ChatGPT and Claude, and especially, you know, Claude Code, things like that, to expand beyond your comfort zone. And so you're actually, a lot of the threat actors are actually able to pivot using some of the tools that are available now to make their, to gain those efficiencies, to make their attacks, their tools, more widespread.
Absolutely. Tony, it always goes back to something you mentioned of the you know, follow the economics of the attackers, and they're looking at advancement, efficiencies, using these elements, as Randy mentioned, in their code pipelines, so that they've got a greater range of targets and greater opportunity. It just kind of falls into that space.
Yeah, Randy, I'm dying to ask you this question. So you've worked this as a nation state level problem also in your prior career. And, you know, we used to say the common wisdom was what separates the nation state or the high end criminal from the mass market joyriding, you know, a low end criminal were things like infrastructure and the ability to bring, I'll call it, a wide variety of tools to bear. You know, that is, because you could see it, some of the ones that hit the public, right, in the last several years. I mean, they're not the work of one or two people. They're people that understand a variety of technologies, build complex attacks that have multiple stages and so forth. In addition to the, what appears to be a well-planned infrastructure to get things in, out, and to manage the effects. Is that part of the democratization here, that we're sort of seeing the emergence of new technology that blurs that distinction? Does that still apply?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the one, you know, you made kind of two comments, right? So there's one that's on the infrastructure side, and then one that's just kind of what bringing this wide tool set to bear. And I think on the one hand, we used to look at sophistication of actors as really being like, look at their entire playbook, look at all these capabilities that they've developed. What's really happened is there's a blurring and we used to always think of that as, you know, foreign state or well-resourced state-aligned actors. And that's what's become really blurry, is that it's, you know, the capabilities that cyber criminal actors have developed look a lot like sophisticated state-level attackers today. And the open access, the coding platforms, the generative AI tools, the automation capabilities, all of those things, even the ransomware as a service infrastructure, the way it's developed over time, where different people specialize in different areas, and it's become very modular, not just in the development of the capability itself, but the teams that are participating are very modular in nature. That entire concept has really made it very difficult to differentiate between what's a criminal action and what's a state sponsored action, right? The sophistication has grown significantly. We used to have chat, or we call them script kiddies. I think we're entering into the era of chat kiddies or you know, GPT kiddies or whatever you want to call them, right? Where they're really starting to level up their game using tools that are available to the general public.
Yeah, we'll call them LLM miners.
There you go.
Awesome. Now, Kyle, we move into the second prediction here, and it's the rise of semi-autonomous malware. So we've seen glimpses of automation already, credential theft, worm-like propagation, and automated payload delivery. So we've got Quackbot, LumaStealer, all providing these types of techniques. So while efficient and effective, neither of these or any current malware are fully autonomous. And then it says yet. So I'm going to look for your prediction. Is this a 2027 or a 2028? But we'll get that there. Instead, they're modular, scripted routines that are an early and important step in the move towards malware capable of chaining processes together with minimal, if any, human direction. So this evolution dramatically shortening the time between initial access and full compromise. So as Kyle, have you seen, you know, this particular element of semi-autonomous malware and this move to fully autonomous? Any thoughts you've seen of new capability in that space this year? And when do you think fully autonomous is going to be with us in causing us headaches in our cyberspace?
Fully autonomous. Hopefully not 2026. I don't recall coming across any examples recently. Or anything suggesting that's, you know, right now. However, one of the things that this brings to mind, I'm actually doing some research on AI prompt injection attacks. So targeting, you know, generative AI platforms, basically just trying to hijack them so that they're under the control of a, you know, they're operating at the behest of an attacker, for example. There was a study actually a couple of years ago. So I was surprised that there was a couple of years ago, they called it the Morris II worm. So what researchers had done, they were testing an LLM in their own environment, and the LLM was a RAG-based email assistant, and the malicious prompt was found in an email, and the point of it was to get the LLM to behave at the behest of the attacker, but also to self-propagate. So any emails that were then sent out from that RAG-based assistant included the prompt with it. So it was just continuously sending out. With that being a couple of years ago, and with generative AI's adoption not slowing down at all, fully autonomous malware, I really hope it's not this year, but it's absolutely within the realm of possibility, yeah. Unfortunately.
Again, Tony, just it's leading us down this path of, you know, when we talk of the evolution and what we've seen in the space, and, you know, we've talked about this a lot of times, is I think it goes back to what Randy was saying as well, is this, the timeline between having an idea and execution. I mean, that's just tightening and tightening and tightening to the point where, you know, we'll do our LLM miners and they'll just go into and just, this is what I want to do. Generated. Okay, away we go. It's an interesting time.
Yeah, and the examples even going back, you know, to like the Morris worm, right? There were self-propagating was the term we used back in the day, right? Things that got your address book, you know, and things like that. But there was more of a sledgehammer approach, right? You know, are you vulnerable? Boom, you know. And there was a relatively small number of tricks that any piece of malware might be able to execute. You know, could detect the nature of the host and what it might have a couple of options there, but that level of smarts is, you know, by today's standards, pretty crude. And here now when you look at a world of agents, you say, oh, I'm in a target I haven't seen before. Maybe I should go get some other capability to bring to bear. You know, you could picture a much more dynamic round of activity that the malware could bring to bear, even in circumstances that it has not seen before. And that's pretty scary business, right? Because now you're talking about tremendous extension of tools that could be brought. And of course, on the flip side, for the defense, you know, as you know, Randy hinted back to the old days, right, where we would try to profile different, you know, we talk about attack patterns, we talk about this, you know, this is the activity that we expect to see from this nation, given all these circumstances. And yeah, that is really, really blurring, right? So it's hard to picture that out. And then of course, the ability to do this at worldwide scale all the time is just still astounding. So, you know, one of my neighbors who's not into technology said, how can there be so many different attacks? Well, I said, because the incremental cost is essentially zero, right? I mean, so this is not like mail fraud where at least you had to buy a stamp, you know, to send something to somebody. The incremental cost, and that's the beauty of it, right? Economically, the scale is just is unmatchable. Yeah. And it's certainly true that the bad guys are more flexible and more more clear in their desired outcome, right? So they're early to take advantage of scale. I think both of you talked a little bit about, right, specialization, you know, the sort of natural self-organization of the ecosystem of criminality itself is something that's been emerging over the last few years. And so, you know, I don't need to do reconnaissance. I buy the output of reconnaissance, right? I don't need to build my own client army. I rent time on somebody else's client army. I don't create tools, I use someone else's tools. And that has been building for years. And, you know, I know it's a bit of an exaggeration, but I always, you know, one of my quips is that, you know, if you want to study economics, you study bad guys, right? If you want to see that, you know, economic efficiency in action, you don't study good guys. Good guys are naturally separated by things like, you know, geography, distance, who they report to, who their owner is, and have to deal with a lot of constraints that bad guys don't worry too much about. And so it's the natural, experimental laboratory for efficiency, you know, for specialization of effort and all that kind of stuff. So I think that's, you know, and I think, you know, you guys have been watching this for a while and you're really seeing it rise. And, you know, Randy, you know, to your point, right, you have to now rethink the analysis itself. It's a different kind of analysis, right? The models that we had back in the day make less and less sense over time, right? How do we characterize different classes of adversary and so forth? It's really different.
Yeah. Well, We're going to extend on that, Tony, when we come back from our break as Crimeware as a Service. So we'll be right back.
Are you a U.S. state, local, tribal, or territorial government?
If so, you know just how difficult cyber defense can get.
You're the frontline defense against cyber threats, yet you don't have the shiny tools, big budget, or skilled talent of an enterprise.
Well, guess what? You don't need them.
You do need a community of like-minded folks to unlock the power of collective cybersecurity.
And that's the superpower of the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center.
The Multi-State ISAC provides cyber underserved organizations with protections they otherwise couldn't afford at a price that works for them.
But it's more than just access to services. It's access to a community of peers where your participation protects them and theirs protects you.
Not to mention access to the 24/7/365 CIS Security Operations Center as your full-time public sector cybersecurity partner.
Available as a single organization or state or territory-wide option, the MSISAC membership provides threat intelligence, monitoring, and more to fortify your cyber defense.
Become a member today by visiting cisecurity.org/ms-isac.
So, Randy, as Tony had provided us some thoughts before the break about now specialization, I don't have to use the tools, I'll just go utilize a service that provides them. And we've got a prediction here of Crimeware as a Service and AI-assisted malware. You want to expand on that a little bit?
Sure. So I think Tony made some really great points that are applicable, and some of Kyle's points applicable to this prediction as well. So, you know, one of the things that we really look at is in the incident response community broadly is dwell time, right? That's the how long has an actor been in a network before they actually launch a specific attack. And that's one of those, you know, you look at the semi-autonomous malware piece that Kyle was just talking about. And when we look at AI assisted malware, that's where I think we're starting to see a major, impact, right? That dwell time is compressing fairly quickly. And it's not that Gen AI and the various AI tools that are available today are creating super malware for us. It's just that, I think, Tony, you used the term democratization earlier, right? It's democratizing availability of tools, of relatively complex tools and skill sets that are turning malware development and criminal activity using malware, whether it's yours or somebody else's, into a commodity action. So the technical debt that's required to learn how to code, to cut your teeth on these things early on and, you know, kind of rise up through the ranks doing this stuff is shrinking significantly. So we're seeing actors who really, you know, probably couldn't code their way out of a paper bag, much like myself, right? Coding is not my strength. They're going out there and running effective, you know, malware campaigns and ransomware campaigns. And then I think the other big area that we're seeing a lot in the Crimeware as a Service model is the effective use of, because, you know, when you think about, I'll say the effective use of social engineering, because when you think about the what generative AI is really good at, it's really only good at one thing, which is predicting the next word in a sentence. Well, it just so happens to have been trained on so much language, especially English, American English, the way we use English in Western countries and cultures, that availability of, it's trained really well on how we speak to each other. It can write a really, really convincing phishing email, which is fascinating when you think about that was, you know, for many, many years, that was how we taught people how to detect phishing email, was look for bad English, look for things that we wouldn't say, look for unprofessional language. And that's gone now. If people are using LLMs to write their phishing emails, they're even using deepfakes to make phone calls to people and to craft text messages, right? So they're using that natural language processing capability as a language, or as a weapon. And that's, I think, where we're really seeing that lowered operational cost that Tony was talking about, the democratization, the equalization across the criminal enterprises.
Very good. Kyle, we move on to the next, which is increased malware use of trusted infrastructure to thwart cyber defenses. So now using and abusing trusted cloud and web services to host malicious resources, this is blending into legitimate traffic, undermining some of our defensive capability. Flagged IPs and domains, not anymore potentially. So we've got to look and think about how we're seeing the attack. And, you know, one thing I reflect on, Kyle, here is as we start to build capable defenses and we build the better mousetrap, it's then the next layer, as it were, of, well, if I can't use unreputable sources, why then don't I change my tactics to reputable sources and platforms? That bypasses elements of defense in depth. Any thoughts on that prediction, Kyle?
Oh, absolutely. This one this one rings true to my day-to-day operations. As you were touching on, the from a defensive perspective, what I like to do to apply security mechanisms for for members or whatever services it is we're providing, I like to try to find some kind of a bottleneck feature, right? What's a domain I could block? or a series of domains I can block that's gonna thwart threat actor activity. Not just now, but also I can throw in some potential future activity. It'll be caught under this umbrella action. By the bad guys taking advantage of the trusted services, there's Cloudflare services, GitHub or like file sharing services like that. I can't apply those domain or IP blocks. In response, what I have tried doing, what some of my other CTI teammates have tried doing, is doing some more behavioral analysis of the code that's involved. So, like for example, social engineering emails, credential harvesting web pages. Well, a lot of times, what we'll try to do is find scripts or series of strings that are in the URLs, the resources that are hosted on these trusted domains, pivot on those and try and find ways to expand our understanding of threat actor infrastructure. And we can use those, the analysis from our findings there to still try to apply some bottlenecking security mechanisms. It can prove difficult. It can be a little bit more time consuming, a little frustrating at times. But especially with like some of the EDR tools that we leverage, we're still very much able to apply the same level of security, maintain protection and awareness, share that information with others. Just got to, like the bad guys, we got to adapt.
So I was going to say, I think there was one case in particular that we had fairly recently where we were seeing adversaries take advantage of Cloudflare will give you test domains, right? And they're these kind of pseudo random subdomains that they provide if you want to test out some Cloudflare services. And we saw threat actors leveraging that. And so we kept seeing these patterns of what looked like four pseudo randomly generated words.cloudflare.com as part of like a major malware campaign. So, you're not seeing some crazy, obscure redirect to, a Dutch infrastructure or something like that, which was a way that we could often tell that this was malicious. This is a trusted Cloudflare domain. So it had to be, us figuring out, our CTI team figuring out, like, how is this pattern, which is a legitimate pattern that Cloudflare creates, in which ways are these patterns being married with other techniques for us to be able to identify that those are malicious in nature?
May I actually share another example of something that I came across recently? It's a combination of trusted service abuse and some generative AI stuff as well. Well, I think it eventually will become a generative AI inclusion. Anyway, we recently became aware of some threat actors they started chats in ChatGPT and Grok, and they were sharing the URLs for how to clear disk space in the Mac OS. Those URLs were shared, and then it had the emojis, had the instructions. It looked all fancy and neat and clean. These are actual conversations hosted at the actual domains. However, like step three or four towards the end, there was a the instruction was essentially run, open the terminal, terminal and run this command. And the command was a base64 encoded get request to threat actor infrastructure to end up pulling an info stealer. I was actually really surprised to see this. I was really surprised to see legitimate chats being shared. They were formatted nicely, looked nice and clean. Unsuspecting users are absolutely going to fall for that. It's a click fix style attack, you know, instead of like a clicking the Cloudflare turnstile or doing a fake captcha or something like that. I thought that this was not only trusted service abuse, you take advantage of, I totally left out that the threat actors had, they leveraged SEO poisoning. So in order to get these URLs to pop up in Google results, they were doing their SEO poisoning tactics. I actually had a feeling that this technique involves manual interaction. A user Google searching something with Gen AI tools, scanning websites and providing summaries. Why not base64 encode that command and have it go into the parsing of someone else's LLM and then perform whatever kind of malicious instructions that you would want a user to do? Just have their LLM do it for you.
Well, I think that goes into the automation element too, right? I mean, it's seeing all of these stages of an attack and then being able to compartmentalize them into a different approach and building your kind of your DevOps malware chain, as it were, in these sections. Very good, Carl. That's a great use case. I really like it. We need to write that up as a white paper, Randy, I think.
On it.
More homework.
Kyle, get to work.
Exactly.
More homework. Exactly. Well, that whole, as Randy said, you know, our history, our business, right, was built upon a notion where trust is a binary condition, and it's a relatively static condition, right? You know, from the earliest days of anti-malware, once I know something is bad, I can derive some properties from it, and I can share those properties with the world. You know, if you see this, if your anti-malware scanner sees this pattern, this string. And by the way, eventually that got so big that no one could keep up. You know, I had visited the signature generation farms of a couple of the big vendors, you know, when I was with the government, and they're amazing machines. I mean, of just tremendous computing capability that actually can't keep up with the problem. And now we have a different problem, which is much more challenging, right? Which is trust is not binary. You know, so if it's binary, then we say, well, I can filter on a URL, on a domain, on a string, on whatever. But that is all, you know, these are great examples, Kyle, that I thought about, which is, you know, now people are going to what they believe are trusted sources, right? I mean, an astounding number, at least of non-technologists in my world think, you know, they say, I Googled for an answer and here it is. They have no idea the manipulation that's happening underneath the hood, you know, deliberately, right, to get them. But it takes them to a place that they believe is a legitimate place, offering them help on a question that they have asked. And now, and by the way, bad guys have gone there knowing people will show some level of trust in there. So trust becomes dynamic. It's sort of negotiated, right, on a moment's notice, you know, and but most users assume it. You know, they still work to that model and say, well, I got it from Google, or I went to the Apple website, or I went to the help site for this vendor. And so, you know, that seems reasonable from a consumer's point of view. But of course, bad guys figured that out just as soon as consumers did, and they're able to take advantage of that. So, I mean, you know, again, our old way of thinking about it, right? Well, Kim, you know, the example Randy gave, legitimate domain, actually legitimate process of generating random, I'm assuming the name's there, right, for testing purposes. But it's not until you see the application of it and combine it with other information that you recognize, I can't trust this. You know, so what do you do? You can't block Cloudflare everything. And at the same time, you can't wait too long, right, because of the natural delay in pulling it together. So where does that take us? I mean, how do we accelerate defense?
Yeah, well, I think that's the dilemma we face, Tony. That's the challenge we accept every day as an organization and as a cybersecurity community. We've got to look at that and understand not only that trust factor, which is very important, But I think it's also the environment in which we're in today. It's a very different, you know, we go back 2, 3, 4 mm-hmm. years. Today, I think it's just a different set of criteria in which we're, the landscape in which we exist, I believe, has fundamentally changed. And how we approach that is, I'll put it this way. I think the proposition of value in which organizations such as ours have to provide needs to continue to develop, augment as we see in the environment. And I feel, you know, that there may have been a few years of incremental evolution of attack up until, you know, let's say 2022, LLMs and things like that, I think have fundamentally changed where we are and the proposition we need to provide organizations. And not reestablishing that trust, but reinforcing that trust is going to be a continued element that all organizations need to prove as part of being representatively the supply chain and in these criteria. And there's so many organizations now with a capability. Tony, and Randy, we'll go to the RSA conference floor, right? The vendor floor. I mean, it's not like there's, you know, football fields of vendor after vendor with great capability, great ideas. How much is enough? Who are the right ones? Which combination of controls are going to help establish and continue that trust? And are they dynamic to an environment that is ever changing? Anyway, I digress. I'll throw it over to Randy. Get your thoughts.
Well, you know, honestly, that pivots into the supply chain prediction really well, which is that, you know, and we've talked about this a lot. I feel like, you know, you and I, Sean, have talked, and I don't remember if we talked about supply chain a lot on the podcast, but I'm pretty sure we've touched it before because it's been part of our predictions now for several years. So, I mean, you know, in terms of supply chain targeting, I can keep it really, really short. It's really basic math, right? The adversaries have figured out the math. Do I leverage a vulnerability in a product against one person, or do I go after the product itself and potentially target, you know, thousands of organizations in one fell swoop? And if we actually have a chat group on Signal with former CTI analysts and people who are currently in CTI, and we share things that the group finds, you know, out in the wild and chat about it. And there was one just recently about a major Fortinet vulnerability. And I think we'd previously talked about Kaseya and a couple others that are these, you know, edge device vendors that are used broadly throughout the community. And one of our former CTI analysts, Sam, actually made a great comment, which is he said, you know, edge device companies are now in the same boat that endpoint software companies were in, like operating system companies were in, you know, 10, 15 years ago. And it's really true. I mean, we're really seeing just strategic targeting of MSPs, edge device. I mentioned Fortinet, but I mean, SolarWinds, everybody knows about from a long time ago. They're still getting hit with stuff. I mean, if you go into the CISA KEV, the known exploited vulnerabilities catalog, and you look at the percentage of vulnerabilities that are in there, I mean, most of them aren't things like Microsoft and Linux. They are, you know, edge devices and security appliances and things like that. So, I mean, it's really quite shocking. But, you know, again, basic math. The attackers have figured it out, and they said, "How do we get the most bang for the buck?" You know, go after the supply chain.
Exactly. Well, again, I think it just goes to the economic element as well. I always refer back to Tony. If I don't say fog of more, I've not said. I don't think I've been on the podcast, so I'll say that just to get it in, Tony.
Duly noted.
Well, I just want to conclude our prediction podcast again with the team, Randy and Kyle. This one hits home. This is the continued loss of federal support for state and local governments. It is going to increase cyber and physical risk. Randy, I want to get your perspective on what we see today from an MSISAC, EIISAC perspective, what we're continuing to do. One, the trust we've built that Tony had mentioned, and establishing greater levels of capability and contribution to decrease those cyber and physical risks. But thoughts there, Randy?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing I'll say is that, you know, here in the U.S., particularly, you know, within our community that the MSISAC supports, the state and local government community, we pay a lot of attention to what's going on at the federal level. We look at, you know, statutes that are coming down, budgets that follow, what the priorities of the federal government are, what the priorities of you know, regional organizations are. We work with a lot of different associations, municipal associations. We partner with them on you know, aligning resources and aligning capability with the needs of the stakeholder community. And that makes a lot of sense, right? As an organization, we're focused in that. We want to hear what the most important things are for school districts and states and cities and municipal water supply systems, things like that. But we're not the only ones that are paying attention to that. Our adversaries are looking at that too, right? Just like they know that school district budgets are public, when they're getting ready to launch ransomware, they're not going after the school district with the $500,000 budget. They're going after the one with the $500 million budget, because at the end of the day, it's about a dollar sign for them. And those are criminal actors, but state actors are looking at it too. So, you know, everything that's out there in the public, in the media about resources that are, you know, maybe available or not available, no longer available for our state and local community, our adversaries see that and they're leveraging it, right? They're paying attention to budget cuts. They're paying attention to communications about where weaknesses might exist. And that's where CIS and the MSISAC team in particular are really trying to fill that gap, because we're keenly aware that this is a primary target for both state actors and criminal actors. And, you know, we can't leave these folks out to dry. A lot of them are, you know, unfortunately severely under-resourced to be able to provide a lot of the security themselves. And that's where the MSISAC can really help. We may not be the perfect fit for every organization, but, you know, we do our best to try to get proactive information out there to, you know, help people solve cyber security issues in real time through our Security Operations Center. We have an incident response team that's available to help organizations, because no matter how proactive you are, there are always going to be incidents. So we're available for that. We have teams that are focused on education, and we're always looking to expand services and provide more for this community. So, you know, as much as the prediction is that, you know, the continued loss of support is going to result in greater risks, our goal is to be there to help, you know, mitigate those risks and build resilience within the community.
Absolutely. Well said, Randy. Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of our episode. That went by too fast. Randy, Kyle, great work, great predictions. Thank you so much for all you do for CIS and the SLTT community. Really appreciate you being on.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
And Tony, my friend, always great to be with you, sir. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. This is part of a conversation, and you know, you're one of the few CISOs that has access to folks, direct access to folks like Kyle. Absolutely. And Randy. So I know it helps drive our program. And also to Randy's closing point, right? I mean, the bad news is we're all connected, therefore we're all affected. The good news is that also provides the opportunity for collective action, right? That is, most folks are not going to be able to afford the talent of Kyle and the team. But the good news is we can, you know, through looking at the system in the whole, we can identify both the problems we have in common, but also the potential solutions. So, yep, that's, you know, that's why we're here, Sean. Plus, we just enjoy chatting with folks like this.
Exactly. And to our audience, thank you. Make sure to subscribe on your preferred podcast provider. Catch us on YouTube at The CI Security. Questions, comments, concerns, email us at podcast@cisecurity.org. And with that, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.